Via Flamenca de Portland, August 30th at the Headwaters Theater in Portland. This month, La Peña's show features artists from the Bay Area and France, including Andrea La Calena, Cristo Cortez, and Ricardo Diaz y Brenna McDonald. Again, that's Peña Flamenca de Portland, August 30th at the Headwaters Theater, located at 55 Northeast Farragut Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 10:59 a.m. Coming up at 11 on the Radio Zine, host Jennifer Kemp speaks with journalist Lou Urenick about his book, The Great Fire, One American's Mission to Rescue Victims of the 20th Century's First Genocide. At 11:30 from the archives, we hear Follow the Garbage, a look at what happens to the stuff we throw out, produced by Lisa Loving and a crew of news volunteers. And speaking of which, thanks KBOO members for your generous support. If you are not currently a member of the KBOO Foundation, you can remedy that oversight at kboo.fm. Click where it says Donate Today.
We set to sail on a packet full of spice, rum and tea leaves. We've emptied out all the bars and the Bowery hotels. And tell your daughter, walk the streets alone tonight.
This is Jennifer Kemp for Political Perspectives. My guest today is author and academic Lou Urenick, and he's here to talk about his book, The Great Fire, One American's Mission to Rescue Victims of the 20th Century's First Genocide. From 1915 to 1922, an estimated over 2 million Armenian people were murdered by Turkish soldiers. This genocide has been largely overshadowed in historical narratives by World War II, and even today, the Turkish government publicly denies that it happened. The U.S. government did nothing to prevent the genocide. The Great Fire tells a harrowing piece of history, but also reads like a novel, inserting anecdotal information about key players, including Asa Jennings and his family. Jennings, an American YMCA worker, courageously risked everything to save thousands of Armenian refugees from the approaching Turkish army and the fire consuming their city of Smyrna. For more on The Great Fire, here's Lou. Set the stage for Smyrna in September of 1922. What was the political situation like, and who were the key players involved?
Well, the political situation was this. The Turkish army, the Turkish National Army, had just entered the city of Smyrna on September 9, 1922. It was an army really in opposition to the main government in Turkey at the time, which was the government based in Constantinople. It was led by an individual called Mustafa Kemal, later known as Atatürk, the father of modern Turkey. And he essentially commanded the government and the army. And he brought the army into Smyrna, as I say. He arrived on the 10th. The army arrived on the 9th. And it was shortly after the arrival of the Turkish army that the slaughter in the city of Smyrna began. Smyrna was a very special city. It was inside the Ottoman Empire. It was a majority Christian city. It was a very prosperous and liberal city. Many different ethnicities and religions had lived together, you know, basically harmoniously inside Smyrna. So it was kind of a city apart from the rest of the Ottoman Empire, Turkey, as it was also called back then. Beginning on the 9th of September, this slaughter began, and then it continued. It was first centered on the Armenian section. The city was divided into sort of ethnic districts. It began in the Armenian section, very brutal. People pulled from their homes, stores looted, women were raped, men, women, and children were killed in the street. Just horrible Then the massacre spread generally over the city to the other Christian sections of the city, and this continued for several days. And to make matters even more horrible, on Wednesday, September 13, the city was set on fire by the army. And it was just a hellish, hellish scene. And as you can imagine, you know, first all of this slaughter, in addition to the 500,000 people who lived at Smyrna, there were 300,000 refugees in the city. These were Christian people who had fled the interior of Turkey ahead of the Turkish army. They were sleeping in the streets, railroad stations, churchyards, wherever they could find a place to put down a blanket. And they, as well as the residents of Smyrna, were pushed by this giant, it became a giant fire. There were four separate fires that were started and then fanned by a very strong wind. They were pushed to the waterfront, where hundreds of thousands of people were trapped between the water, the harbor, and this very big fire. You know, by midnight on the 13th, the fire was actually 2 miles long and a mile deep. You can just imagine how hot it was. In fact, it was so hot that the ships that were in the harbor, there were many warships, American warships, British, French, Italian, they had to pull up their anchors and drop further back into the harbor because the flammables on their decks, the canvas, the rope lines, and so forth, were beginning to ignite. So for the people who were caught on the promenade, so-called the quay at Smyrna, which is the narrow strip of pavement that describes the edge of the harbor, it was a scene right out of hell. They were jumping into the water to avoid being burned to death. People were drowning. Women were trying to cover their babies with wet blankets to avoid them, you know, being burned to death. It was really just a horrible, horrible scene.
So, okay, give us some historical background on the relationships between, say, the Greeks, the Turks, and the Armenians. And you mentioned this slightly in the beginning of the first question, which was great. But how does Mustafa Kemal fit into this dynamic?
Sure. Well, Smyrna was the final episode of a genocide, a religious cleansing that had swept over Turkey beginning in 1912. It lasted 10 years. 3 million people were killed in this genocide. The Armenian genocide, which many people are familiar with, occurred in 1915 and 1916 inside this broader killing that occurred. So the Ottoman Empire, for many centuries, was a big and powerful empire, stretched from the Arabian Sea all the way well into Europe. But by the beginning of the 20th century, the Ottoman Empire was in very sharp decline, and it was losing territory, it was bankrupt, and there was a kind of paranoia, an anxiety that seized the elite in the Ottoman Empire about the future of the empire. This paranoia went in search of a scapegoat. And the elite settled on the Christian population as the problem. So it began what it called at the time a campaign for a Turkey for the Turks, a kind of cleansing of the population, the removal of the Christian population to build a fully Islamic nation. Began in 1912 and continued through the war. Intensified during the war. Then, of course, the Ottoman Empire was defeated by the British, the Allies, in World War I, along with Germany. And so for a period of time, the killing stopped, you know, for, let's say, less than a year, for months. But soon this nationalist movement arose in Turkey, and it was led by Mustafa Kemal, a brilliant military tactician, a very singular-minded person who had a vision for a new Turkey. He was ruthless in the implementation of his vision, but he put together a government and an army, and beginning in the end of 1919, essentially, and it grew 1920, 21, 1922, and by 1922, it was really it was the most powerful force inside Turkey. It set the stage for the army's occupation of Smyrna.
What was the American response to the events occurring in Smyrna, and why?
Well, the Americans had a big presence in Smyrna. It had historically been a missionary station. Many missionaries, especially from New England, the Congregational Church, but others as well, had gone to Smyrna, and so there were orphanages and medical facilities and two very big high schools, as well as the YMCA and the YWCA. America also had a very big commercial presence in Smyrna. It was the principal port of export for Turkish tobacco, which made the American cigarette industry possible. Americans also sold products there. Standard Oil of New York had a big oil depot there, Singer sewing machines, lots of agricultural equipment and so forth. So Smyrna was the richest city in the Ottoman Empire. It may have been the richest city in the entire Mediterranean as a consequence of its trade with the rest of the world. And America definitely was participating in that trade. And so we had a big presence there, both a business and missionary presence at Smyrna.
But I guess I was wondering kind of more like what was happening in Washington.
I see. Sure.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, you know, the fate of the Christian minority inside Turkey at the time was a very big issue in the United States. There was a tremendous outpouring of philanthropy and goodwill toward the Greeks and especially the Armenians in Turkey before World War I, during World War I, and after World War I. Everybody seemed to be raised. The Near East Relief was the principal fundraiser, but you know, nearly everybody was contributing. Churches, schools, labor unions, factories, police departments, library guilds, you know, children selling lemonade on street corners. Tremendous amount of money was raised to help the Christian minority, especially the Armenians in Turkey. So there was a very strong feeling inside the United States among the public and especially among religious leaders that the United States needed to be involved somehow to prevent the massacre of this Christian minority inside Turkey. But that feeling, that sense, was directly at odds with the point of view of the State Department and of the president. The president at the time was Warren Harding, and he was very much an isolationist. In other words, he had no interest in foreign involvement. His principal concern was domestic issues. He had been elected on a platform, so-called return to normalcy, to get the United States out of international activities. The Senate had rejected the League of Nations and had turned its back on Woodrow Wilson and his internationalism and so forth. There was this kind of difference between how a very large proportion of the public felt and how the government felt. And at the same time, the government was very aware, again, this sense was very much centered in the State Department, that the United States needed oil from the Mideast. We were already experiencing our first oil crisis in 1920. And there was a sense that the United States needed to play a strategic game in Turkey in order to protect access to oil reserves in that part of the world. Iraq was just emerging as a nation, and the Ottoman Empire was being carved up into these so-called mandates, Syria, Iraq, Palestine, Lebanon, and so forth. Those were all new things at the time. And so that was another reason that the government didn't want to get involved. It didn't want to get on the wrong side of the new Turkish government. And as a consequence, the United States elected not to get involved in the slaughter and all of these problems that were occurring. They were centered on Smyrna, but they were, you know, really widespread throughout Asia Minor. So there was no rescue, at least no government rescue as such. And the story that I tell in the book that I think is so compelling is that, you know, after the fire, after, you know, as this slaughter is continuing, we had a couple of Americans, one American in particular, who stepped forward. And he was a person without any kind of official portfolio. And these Americans, and this one American in particular, his name was Asa Jennings, put together an American Relief Committee to help the refugees, and then they went on to do something even more ambitious and grander. And over the course of the story, I tell how Jennings with the help of a very courageous and capable U.S. naval officer, was able to put together a rescue, and they removed 250,000 people from the city of Smyrna, people who were essentially facing a death sentence, removed them from Smyrna and evacuated them to Greece, where they were safe. And so that's kind of the spine of the story in the book, is this extraordinary effort, one sort of small step at a time, and then a couple of very big steps, and really bold and almost outrageous steps on the part of Asa Jennings and Halsey Powell, the naval commander, to rescue all of these people who were destitute, who were vulnerable, and who were in fact being killed at Smyrna.
Can you give a little more background on each of these individuals? What were they doing there? Where had they come from? How did they get involved with saving refugees?
Yeah, you know, I'd love to, because it's really the reason I got involved in the story in the first place. I was interested in to find out who was this person, Asa Jennings, who had achieved so much. Well, Jennings was the least likely hero that you could imagine. He was a minister from upstate New York who really had not been very successful as a minister and had joined the YMCA. And the YMCA at the time was a missionary organization, and it had a chapter at Smyrna. He was a little man, and he had a lot of health problems. In his 20s, he had suffered from tuberculosis and then Pott's disease, which had left him disabled and in bad health. He, you know, nearly every day of his life, he had a high fever. He had a lot of pain in his back and thorax as a consequence of a spinal infection and the collapse of his spine. So he didn't look like a hero, but he definitely turned out to be. He was at Smyrna. He had just arrived, actually, to a new job when the Turkish, just about the time that the Turkish army was arriving. Despite his handicaps, had lots of energy, wanted to be useful. He was kind of a little motor of a man, very cheerful, always looking for a way to help people. And he went into action. You know, he was at the right place at the right point in history to put in place. He, you know, he came out of a tradition of religious service, helping other people. And it was a big part of his character, his upbringing and so forth. And he put that into use at Smyrna. You know, he had huge empathy for suffering. The person who assisted him, you know, provided kind of the logistical support for the rescue is equally interesting. He was a naval officer from a small town in Kentucky, McAfee, Kentucky. He had gone to the Naval Academy, had a very brilliant naval career even before Smyrna. He was a hero during World War One. He had an instinct for rescue. He had performed just an amazing sea rescue of British sailors after their ship had been sunk by a German U-boat. He arrived at Smyrna about the middle of the month. And he worked for, you know, his direct report, you know, as a Navy officer, was to an admiral in Constantinople. I have to say, was a despicable person. I hate to say that about another American, but it's true. And he was a racist.
Who was that admiral? What was his name?
Yeah, his name was Mark Bristol. And he didn't like Greeks and Armenians and Jews, and, you know, he really didn't want his naval officers to participate in a rescue. He made it very clear to his naval officers that they were to remain neutral, not get involved in saving the lives of Ottoman citizens. These Greeks and Armenian Christians in Smyrna were Ottoman citizens. You know, it was hands-off as far as Bristol was concerned. Nonetheless, our hero, our other hero, Halsey Powell, Lieutenant Commander Halsey Powell, commanding a destroyer, actually three destroyers and ultimately five destroyers at Smyrna, found a way to work around Bristol. He took advantage of poor communication. You know, communication was not easy in those years. They used radio telegraph, and that was not reliable. He obfuscated, he delayed, he did all of the things he needed to do in order to participate in the rescue. And in the end, the rescue was so successful, and the American public so impressed and gratified by what had happened, he was not going to suffer any reprimand at the hands of Bristol. The incredible thing is they were given a deadline by the Turkish army to get everybody out of there in 7 days, which was an impossibility, but they managed to do it. They removed 250,000 people in 7 days. They were running ships round the clock between Smyrna and Lesbos, a Greek island nearby, and they were doing it with Greek ships that Jennings had managed to acquire in a most astonishing way. The evacuation really began with a bribe that Jennings paid to an Italian ship captain that allowed him to remove 2,000 refugees. He brought those refugees to Lesbos. He saw that there were many other empty ships at Lesbos, and so he set about kind of doing what he had to get those ships. He kind of misrepresented his credentials. He certainly exaggerated the extent to which the U.S. Navy was willing to help. In a way, he even extorted a foreign government. But, you know, he was intent on saving lives. When his negotiations and his parleying was complete, you know, he was commanding 50 ships. And those ships came into Smyrna Harbor. They were escorted by a U.S. destroyer that was commanded by Halsey Powell. So it was quite a stirring spectacle. You can just imagine, you know, we have an American warship leading this line of empty Greek freighters into Smyrna to make a rescue of all these, in particular, women and children. The Turkish army was not going to release the Greek and Armenian men, but they would the women and children and old men. Well, you know, it's a story that I think we as Americans can be proud of. You know, our government wasn't necessarily acting on principle at the time. You know, there was more of an element of self-interest and strategy going on in Washington, concern about oil and commercial advantages and so forth. But we surely can be proud of Asa Jennings and Commander Powell. These were two individuals who were put to the test, in a sense. You know, they were in a really difficult situation, and they acted on their conscience in a way, and with great skill and in different ways, and they managed to execute one of the great rescues in history. And it is quite astonishing that so few Americans know about it.
So you're just saying, why don't more people know about this rescue? And then what I'm also interested in is, why don't more people know about the Armenian genocide period, and why has that been kind of forgotten in the international public narrative?
Well, those are great questions, and thank you for answering. You know, it's important that we remember the Armenian genocide. It was a period of extreme suffering and death, and it was a genocide that set the pattern, in a way, for what would happen later in the 20th century. You know, Hitler was fascinated by what had happened in Turkey. He spoke about the Armenians just before he invaded Poland and was, you know, creating the so-called living space for Germany. It is a hugely significant event in world history. So we need to know about the Armenian genocide, and actually the broader Christian genocide that lasted so long, these 10 years in Turkey. Absolutely need to know about it. And by the way, the Turkish government's project of denial is a distortion of history. There is no controversy, really, or no doubt, I should say, surrounding the Armenian genocide. There were plenty of witnesses and documents. Many Americans, missionaries, diplomats, businessmen, others witnessed the genocide. So it's a fact of history, and to deny it is a distortion. So, you know, why don't we know about it? Good question. And here's part of the answer. After all of these events were over, early in the 1920s, let's say 23 and 24, the United States government had to make a decision about whether it would have diplomatic and commercial relations with Turkey. A lot of people in the country said no. Turkey has blood on its hands. We shouldn't be involved with this regime. The government, on the other hand, is, again, especially the State Department, and the leader in the State Department in the Near East area was a man named Alan Dulles, who would go on to be famous as the leader of the CIA when it was eventually formed. So there was a big debate in the country, yes or no, on Turkish relations. And the State Department undertook a propaganda campaign to diminish the extent of the genocide and to argue really that it was a dispute between the Armenians and the Turks. It was a local matter, a kind of tit-for-tat set of killings. That was not accurate. It was misrepresenting what had happened historically and so forth, but it really pushed that argument hard, and it had an impact on public opinion. And then, of course, the Turkish government subsequently, you know, has made a project of denying the genocide. It spends a lot of money around the world on propaganda, on lobbying, and so forth. And unfortunately, that American State Department attitude back in the 1920s, coupled with this ongoing Turkish government project to deny the genocide, has sort of pushed it back in public consciousness. It created a sense of, you know, controversy where there is, should not be any controversy. It, you know, it is a fact of history. And many scholars and other, including Turkish scholars, have looked at it. And there clearly was a plan to eliminate the Christian population of Turkey. And there was an intense period in 1915 and 1916 when that effort centered especially on the Armenians.
So what is your personal connection to this part of the world or this time period in history?
I was drawn to the story. I just thought it was such an important story, and I was drawn to the characters. They really did something very big and very important, and I wanted to find out who they were. I knew a little bit about Asa Jennings when I began the book, not a lot, but I learned a lot along the way. I talked to his grandchildren. I read his papers and letters and so forth. I went to the places where he grew up. So I learned a lot about Asa Jennings. Halsey Powell was a surprise to me that I came in the research. So it was really a project that didn't come out of a personal connection as such, but really just, a really big interest in these two individuals, and then more generally what was happening in that part of the world in those years.
Absolutely. On a slightly lighter note, you include many details that are somewhat unusual in a strictly political book, such as descriptions of family relationships, clothing choice, lavish dinner parties.
Right.
What were your reasons for these stylistic choices?
Well, I wanted the book to be a story. I definitely wanted it to be historically accurate, right down to the most precise bit of detail. You know, it's not a book in which I'm making up facts or, you know, creating conversations, that sort of thing. It's a historical book, but I wanted it to read as a story in which real people had real lives and interacted with each other and so forth. And I was fortunate in that many of the people close to the story were good diarists. You know, I knew where they went for dinner and for entertainment and, you know, what had happened to them on a daily basis, you know, even how they were dressed and their relationships with family members and others and so forth. I carefully selected that detail from diaries and reports and other places and wove it into a story. And so my hope is that it reads in almost in a sense, let's say, like a novel, not a piece of fiction, but, you know, it reads like a novel in that there is a story. You want to find out what happens next and why did this person do what he did, that sort of thing.
Well, thank you so much again, Lou, for taking the time to speak with me.
My pleasure. You asked really good questions. And
And that was Jennifer Kemp speaking with journalist Lou Jurenik about his book, The Great Fire, One American's Mission to Rescue Victims of the 20th Century's First Genocide. Speaking about the Armenian Genocide, a bright and cheerful topic for a bright and cheerful morning on KBOO Portland. Coming up, Follow the Garbage, a look at what happens to the stuff we throw out. That was produced by KBOO alum Lisa Loving with a crew of volunteers. That's right. This is volunteer-powered, listener-sponsored community radio. So if you are not yet a member of the KBOO Foundation, why not join up right now? KBOO.fm. Click where it says donate today. And now, let's follow that garbage.
Hello, my name is Lisa Loving from KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, and you're listening to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases stories and other radio productions from community radio stations around the country. Today on Sprouts, Follow the Garbage, an exploration of exactly what happens to the stuff we throw out. Stay tuned.